This week on The Deep Dive, we focus on What Remains of Edith Finch, a collection of short stories about a cursed family in Washington State. We follow Edith Finch as she explores the history of her family and tries to figure out why she's the last Finch left alive. The game is developed by Giant Sparrow in Santa Monica, California, published by Annapurna. It was directed and written by Ian Dallas with a score from Jeff Brusso. It is recommended that you play the game before listening, as we're going to dive deep, and in the abyss, there be spoilers. Without further ado, let's descend.
A lot of this isn't going to make sense to you, and I'm sorry about that.
I'm just going to start at the beginning, with the house.
I lived here until I was 11, but I wasn't allowed inside half the rooms. My brother Milton disappeared when I was 4. It was like the house just swallowed him up.
Even after I inherited the house, I never thought I'd come back to it.
I hadn't been back since my brother Lewis's funeral.
But now I had questions about my family that only the house knew the answers to.
Thank you for joining us. Today I have with me Captain, my co-host, and we have Tadriel joining us. From the Twitchverse. Todd, do you want to let us know a little bit about you? And
yes, absolutely. I'm Tadriel. I am the community manager for the Geek Generation on Twitch, as well as geekgeneration.com. You can find me on Twitter at Tadriel, or over at thegeekgeneration.com, or twitch.tv/thegeekgeneration.
Edith Finch begins with a young 16-year-old Edith. She's approaching her old house, and she's going through memories that she has of her family, stories that she was told about how they died, and kind of recalling what she knows about her family, or what she was told as a young girl about her family. Some are surreal stories with a bit of a fantastical flair. Others are sad, and some even quite disturbing. But it is a collection of stories or memories, or the stories that we tell about people when we lose them. I found the bath scene difficult. With the little kid in the bath, because it's just like, you know what's about to happen.
Right.
Yet you can't stop it from happening, and it's got this beautiful music. And
yeah, that was how the whole game was for me, I think, which is why I really enjoyed it. You were talking about how you were jumping between characters and you didn't like that, Cap.
Well, I mean, it's not that I didn't like it. I guess it kind of pulls me out of, like, the overarching narrative a little bit.
Okay.
It makes it harder for me to focus on what exactly I'm supposed to be getting out of this experience if I kind of lose that focus, especially since it's such a short game. But, I mean, that's not necessarily a fault against the game. That's just sort of my play style more than anything.
What do you think the overarching narrative was?
Well, I think overall the game, you know, is about... You need to not wrap yourself up in your own expectations about how life should be lived, especially if you're a parent. You know, you shouldn't wrap yourself up in how you expect your children to live their lives or how it should be lived, but more so listening and learning about other people and sort of opening yourself up to those differences between each other, and not really forcing any certain type of perception on them. And then beyond that, the game is also, you know, about perception versus reality and potentially mental illness, which was something that I didn't really think about until earlier today. So we can talk about all that. It's going to be super exciting.
Do you think, sorry, just to ask you a question there, Kat, do you think that it was Edie that was forcing expectations on her kids, or do you think it was both Edie and Dawn? So Edie being the great-grandmother of Edith, and then Dawn being Edith's mother.
See, that's interesting, because I don't see Edie as malicious like I do Dawn.
Really? Okay, let's talk about that, because I think the exact opposite.
Really?
Yes, I do. Let's discuss. Okay. So why do you... Yeah, exactly. So why do you think that she's malicious, Dawn?
Because Edie's stories are... And I feel like this is going to bite me in the ass for saying this. It's about intent versus impact, right? You'll hear me say this in probably every episode, because it's something that I feel like is really important. Edie's stories are not... They don't have malicious intent. It's about bringing, you know, this like sense of wonder and joy and fantasy to the things that has happened to her family. And that's, I guess, like her way of coping, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. We'll dive into that, I think, a little bit later. But you take Dawn, and she just wants to shut that shit down, man. Mm-hmm. And you don't do that to kids. You know, you have to let them have that imagination. You can use it as, you know, somewhat of a teachable moment, you know, to sort of say, okay, well, you know, this is reality, this is fiction, this is fantasy, this is imagination. But it's like she doesn't even want that part to exist.
Yeah, and I find that really troubling. Yeah. I think, honestly, between the two, I don't think either of them have different intentions. I think they both love each other and their family. I think they're just interpreting the circumstances differently. So I think Edie, like you said, is trying to cherish those memories, regardless of how dark they can be. And like you said, wanting to make them a bit more fantastical, which I think this entire game is like centered around fantasy and the ideas of these deaths, not the actual like reality of the deaths. And how the mom just like that consumed her to a point of the opposite side of the spectrum. It like sent her into depression and she wanted to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do. There is a specific line where Dawn says, "My children are dead because of your stories."
Mm-hmm.
So I saw Edie as, well, because the first death that we experience in throughout the story is Molly, which is Edie's first child. And Molly is sent to bed hungry, like without dinner, and the door is locked from the outside, so she can't get out. And the bathroom is decorated with something that is potentially a poisonous berry, is what we're led to assume. And she seems pretty neglectful as a parent. And I think that if, let's say, for example, Molly did die due to Edie's neglect, it would be so easy for Edie to paint a story of a family curse to help her cope with that. I didn't kill my daughter, a family curse did. And then if you look at other characters in the story, like I think his name's Calvin, I'm now forgetting. That's the young kid on the swing, right? Calvin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so Calvin, and he's already got a broken leg when we see him. So we don't know if it's just, you know, young kids being kids or if it is painting a picture of neglect, but who puts a fucking swing on the edge of a cliff to mm-hmm. where not even a full swing could potentially harm the kids? I just feel mm-hmm. like there's a lot of, and then Edie's got this weird article actually that you stumble across about the mole man living under the house. Edie does an interview about that, and then it says, you know, Edie did an interview about this and mom was furious.
It's really interesting. I didn't take any of that literal.
Edie had to sit down and do an interview about her only living son who's living under the house because he was so terrified of what happened to Barbara. So to me, it feels like Edie is very wrapped up in all of this, you know, this story that she painted for herself, whether or not it because of mental illness or because she needed it to survive. But I do very much feel like her stories were dangerous, and telling these tales to children to say, oh, you know, there's a curse haunting you. You know, Walter hid under the house for 30 years because he was terrified of a curse, of this something that was going to come and get him, the same thing that killed his sister. Some crazy no matter what I do, something's going to come and attack me. And I just, I don't know. I feel Edie's neglect, or even just if she got wrapped up in it, she's responsible for that.
I find it really, really interesting that you accuse her of being neglectful. I don't feel like she was neglectful. Not to, you know, we're talking about Molly, right? That was the first death in the game. You especially have to consider the time period. If you're, we didn't really have any context for why Molly was even sent to bed hungry. You know, like, are they actually like not feeding their children, or like, you know, it in a time like that, especially, you know, sending your kid to bed without dinner and locking them in their room is not an abnormal thing.
But letting
and
your
maybe it was just childhood curiosity is what killed Molly.
I like what you
touched
on though.
Neglect.
With the stories being dangerous, I think the stories are, but I don't connect that to Edie. I think you're right in that Edie was wrapped up in them, but I don't think that she caused any of this, any of like the death, or I don't think she was intentionally trying to cover anything up.
Oh, of course. I don't think she was intentionally trying to cover anything up, but I do think that she got wrapped up in either her grief or a need to have a narrative that was this is a family curse and it's not my fault. Because even with Walter, she lets a young boy, instead of getting him the help that he needs, lets him live under a house for 30 years and then, you know, does an interview in a magazine about a story about, you know, this mole man living under the house, so that it perpetuates the family curse idea to the whole neighborhood. She builds shrines for these stories. You know, she paints portraits herself, which on the surface seem to be very loving thing to do, but the fact that Barbara's comic book about her death is in her room on display is really messed up. And so I can see why Dawn would be upset and say, you know, you telling the whole family that it's the curse that killed all of us is just making it harder for them. Especially if, and I know we haven't quite talked about the mental illness part yet, but let's say, for example, Edith does have, and by Edith, I mean Edie, sorry, has a mental illness, and the whole family, they all suffer from mental illness. And she's saying, no, no, it's a curse. It's a family curse. And Dawn, who grows up, educates herself, and becomes a teacher and goes out trying to help people, says, no, we have an illness and we need to address it. And your stories are what's killing our family, because no one will go out and get the help that they need. Walter stayed a hermit under the ground. Who else? Oh God, the worst one, Lewis, didn't get the help he needed. Lewis was waiting for his fantastical story, his grandiose end, and in the end, he was face to face with the fact that his day-to-day life was super monotonous and boring, so he killed himself. Like, I just feel like there are a lot of ways that the game can be interpreted, but I definitely feel like I think Edie is a little bit more, I don't see her as this cute old woman telling funny stories, happy memories anymore.
I don't think she's a cute old woman either. I think, but I just don't think she has any malicious or sinister intent. I think she just is guilty, and she's living life being guilty, and she has no way of letting, you know, her life get in the way of the death around her.
Oh, absolutely. But that doesn't necessarily mean she's not a toxic person to be around. Like, she can have all the good intent in the world, but if she's wrapped up in her own narrative and causing damage to those around her, I can completely understand why Dawn would react the way that she did and want nothing to do with her. I get that.
I was reading some of the interviews with the creative director, Ian Dallas, and that's, I think, one of the main things that centered around the entire game was, you know, how death is interpreted by others, and how we, when we lose people, we create these fantastic stories of them, and we kind of lose the actual sense of who they were and the reality of who they were as people. And I think each of these stories very astutely kind of showed that. And she became that perpetuator of these false narratives of these people. Because we don't actually know how every single one of them died. We don't know the true hard facts of how they each died. It was a story. So I think, yeah, she just got wrapped up in the whole story of it all.
Also sort of a potentially a commentary on like how modern society deals with death in general, and how the farther back in time you go, the more common it was to discuss and to recognize that death is an inevitability and it's something that's going to happen. Whereas nowadays, you know, it's like, it's very like, oh, we don't talk about that. You know what I mean? So I find that the fact that she felt the need to make these stories sort of a little bit of a play, you know, sort of a commentary on the fact that it's a problem, mm-hmm. that we feel the need to, I guess, romanticize and sort of turn death into this spectacle, or, you know, on the other side, on the flip side, this thing that needs to, that the literal definition of it needs to be avoided at all costs, for, you know, whatever your reasoning is for that.
Oh man, that's crazy to think about. Actually, I just actually went back and started thinking about actual funerals that I've been at, where, you know, it's kind of commonplace now for people to try to tell a funny story.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember a specific instance where a friend sort of embellished a story about a mutual friend of ours that had passed away, mm-hmm. just because they wanted to show the best, the best characteristics of that person who is now gone. So that is interesting to think about it in that way, especially in regards to Edith and those stories as well.
So that's why I chose this, because this game, like when I was younger, I dealt with a lot of death in our family, and I was that, like I was that, my family's sitting at the table crying. I get up on the table and I tell this like story of my uncle coming to me at night and telling me that everything's going to be okay and everyone should be okay. And I'm like 5 years old and they laugh at me. Like my family tells that story every time Thanksgiving comes around. Like it's a thing. So I think that's why I love this game so much, because it touches on the two sides of death and grieving and what we do when we lose things, because it's one of the only things that we're promised, death. So it's like, we always know it's there. It's going to happen. Like the Finches knew it was always there. They always somehow knew when someone was dead or when it was going to happen.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so I think that's, for me, it's not so black and white as far as like Edie had this intention or Don had this intention. It was this, how life is. It was very murky. They weren't sure what to do. And I think mm-hmm. Don just had so much love for her family. She didn't want it to go on to her family, which is why eventually she left and married that guy and did that thing. But I don't know.
But in the end, he died too.
Yeah, exactly. Then you have Edie, who is like grasping to this idea. She's accepting it almost. She's like, okay, fine, the death is coming, let it come.
Mm.
But still, at the end of the day, you have that same result, which is like painfully beautiful.
I like that interpretation, that the game is just about maybe a perspective of death and that death is inevitable. But I do also think I like the interpretation that it is a story about mental illness and how dangerous it can be to not address that for what it is and to, mm-hmm. you know, paint it as a curse. Because mm-hmm. I do feel like that's something that, you know, it's still done now, but especially at that time period back then, mm-hmm. they wouldn't have addressed that. They would have just said, oh, they would have probably called it melancholy. That's what they called it. Oh, I'm writ with melancholy.
Yeah.
What they call depression. So
not how that works.
Yeah, exactly. That's not how that goes. There was a particular scene, probably my favorite in the game. And Cap, I think I remember you saying something about it when we played through it. But it's Walter, I think, was my favorite. When he says, I need to stop living the same day, even if it kills me. And it's got that narrative text that comes up as he's pounding on the wall, and it keeps, his text keeps coming in with the pounding. I feel like that kind of really spoke to me,
mm-hmm.
because I feel like it's very easy for me to fall into that repetition. And then it happens again, obviously, with Lewis, where he's doing the same thing every single day.
Dear Mrs. Finch, as Lewis's psychiatrist, I can understand your desire for an explanation. As I see it, the trouble began in January, shortly after we convinced your son to seek treatment for substance abuse. Newly sober, I believe Lewis first noticed the monotony of his daily life. He kept working at the cannery, but he withdrew part of himself. In our sessions, I saw the same behavior. His mind began to wander. I had hoped he'd find himself, but he found something more. He began to forget the world we know. It became a game for him. I think it pained him to remember Lewis, the cannery worker. I worried about him then. Daydreaming at the cannery. I spoke with his boss. But he said Lewis had become a model employee. Methodical, tireless, focused. Like a whole new Lewis. So I let him go on.
Oh man, Lewis's was my favorite. Hands down.
They did such unique things with the actual gameplay, like how to interact with the story, even the fact that, you know, his imagination slowly taking over and that you have to continue with your right hand doing the monotonous thing. And then with your left hand, you're controlling his daydream. That was very.
And eventually he takes over and you're not even doing it anymore. And you're outside of him, which was really powerful for me. I was just like, what the fuck is this? Like, I'm outside of myself, which I think for me in that moment, that was the clearest image of like mental illness and what Lewis was going through and how he was so stuck in this imagination, which, by the way, that whole entire bit is based upon a story called The Coronation of Mr. Thomas Shap by Lord Dunsany. And they built that whole thing around this like short story that is like almost play by play exactly what Lewis's narrative is.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's good shit. It's really good shit. That author actually like influenced like Lovecraft and Tolkien, and it's like really deep, far back, like early 20th century, good fiction.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, Lewis's story fully resonated with me, 100%.
I feel like a lot of us at least know what it feels like to fall into a pattern that we are unsatisfied with. I think with Lewis, I think it's interesting, two different perspectives. So if we go with the theory or the idea that it is just Edie's stories that are very elaborate and magical almost, what would it be like if you were Lewis and everybody in your life had this crazy, fantastic story and narrative around them? And that's all you knew, because that's all you grew up hearing, is this crazy, amazing version of them. You know, about the boy who learned to fly, and you sit there thinking to yourself, well, I am nothing special.
Right. I chop fish heads.
So
I just want to be seen, kind of thing.
Yeah. Where's my fantastic story?
Mm-hmm. Which he created his own.
Yeah, he did create his own, but then he ended up killing himself.
Yeah.
Because he didn't feel like, I guess, he had that fantastic story.
Yeah. The reality wasn't as true as it was in his head.
I think actually he's not the only one that makes statements like that, though, right? He says, I am seeing things that aren't really there. Like the world that I've imagined it to be is clearer than my real life. And there are a couple of other characters like that too, right? I can't remember. I know Edie says it. Edie says it in her little narrative at the very end that Edith ends up reading. Edie talks about, you know, weird hallucinations almost kind of weaving through. But I thought there was one other character that... Oh, it's Milton, right? It's the kid who goes missing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the little kid.
Yeah.
It's such a short... I think it's a really... It's like a two-minute scene with that.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, did you ever play The Unfinished Swan?
No, but it was the same company, right?
Yeah, it's the same group. And
same group of people?
Yeah, so... This is super crazy, and I've only found out about this today, but there are parallels between those two games. So Milton, who found the magical pen and opened a door into another world, he is the king in that game, in the Unfinished Swan. Yeah, painting like this town and whatnot. The logo is the same, and the characters are drawn pretty much the same way, and they have come out and said, yeah, it's supposed to be the same character, which is interesting if you look at it just on a surface level. But if you follow the theory that, you know, they're all suffering from, or there is a significant strain of mental illness in the family, Milton's is it schizophrenia, right, Cap, that they say Milton would have?
That's the theory, yes.
That's one of the theories, yeah. I think that's super interesting then if you look at it through that lens, because the idea then is that that's where his psyche splits and he goes mm-hmm. into his own little world that he's then painted, which which is another layer. And it's just super fascinating. And I love that kind of theory and that kind of diving down into something when you're not really sure, when there's no real clear cut answer. Right. I love theorizing about stuff mm-hmm. for sure. Kind of leaves the game open to a lot of different stuff.
So many layers.
Man, that is another example of Edie's neglect, to me at least. Milton's story, getting him a tower, making him a tower where he isolates himself and paints and doesn't speak. That's, I feel like, I don't know.
No, I mean, I definitely understand where you're coming from, and it's something to consider, but I also feel like it's something that maybe the game just doesn't address enough, or maybe just doesn't address directly enough. I hope my memory is not escaping me here. What I would really actually like to see, we have a flashback of Edie, right? It's close to the end of the game, and she's walking down onto the beach, I think, and like into the water, but then the water just kind of disappears, and she's walking through the rocks and comes up to that gate and opens it up, and that's the old house, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
But that's what we don't see, and I feel like that's sort of where the meat is as far as where Edie's intentions really come from, is her past, you know what I mean? And sort of that time period of her life that we don't really get to see.
Yeah.
So it tends to be really difficult to make a direct, sort of evaluation of that. But it does sort of, you know, make you think about other similar situations that you've seen, you know, stories reading the news, or, you know, maybe even family members, whatever the case may be, where you kind of have to draw that line of intent and figure out where it stops, you know, where somebody can say, oh, well, I did the best I could, you know, for my children, or whatever the case may be. And when you kind of take that and say, okay, well, I understand that, you know, you did what you thought was right, but it wasn't enough, and now you're hurting your children, and you know, something has to be done to remedy that situation. And I guess sort of how much you fault someone for that is can be really tough to actually distinguish.
Yeah. I feel like PB, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you could just be theorizing, but I feel like you want to give blame to her.
I don't want to give blame to her, but I feel like my personal journey, particularly in the last couple of years, has been identifying toxic people or relationships. And for me, Edie, it doesn't have to be anybody's fault to be a bad situation, I guess. And it's important to learn how to identify that when it's happening. So when I originally played the game, I didn't think anything of her. I didn't think, and I don't think she has malicious intent, but when I read the theory about mental illness running through the family, I started to really think about it, and I started with Molly's experience. I remember thinking, because she says a line, something like, you know, there's a monster coming to eat me and devour me, and it needs to feed, and we both know I will be delicious.
I held my breath for a long time, but I couldn't.
I just remember that giving me goosebumps, because it made me think of depression. It made me think of a great mental
monster
illness beast.
Feed, yeah.
Yeah. That needs to feed, and it is going to consume me. And that it just, you know, and I know she was, you know, such a young girl to be going through that, but that's immediately what I thought of. So when I read the theory on, you know, the mental illness strain through the family, I thought, okay, well, what characters do kind of show that mental illness? And then I started thinking about Edie, and because, you know, it's, some of these are genetic and go all the way back, and she does exhibit a lot of
absolutely.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah, I think it would make sense for them to all have a predisposition towards some kind of illness mentally.
Yeah, I she kind of borderline to, you know, when I think about that, and just how, you know, wrapped up she got up in the attention of the media, and how her pictures in the paper for you know, not wanting to move her house and it, you know, even her child Star, you know, all this stuff. And even just, yeah. And it, just one thing led to another where I just thought, oh my God, you know, what if it is, you know, even at the end, I think it's very brief and it could be open to interpret. It could be heart medication. It could be anything. Mm-hmm. But Dawn says, you know, you shouldn't be drinking with your medication.
Right. Which, yeah, that was a clear nod to something.
Yeah. So, and I mean, it could be anything, but it just, it made me think, okay, well, what if it is? And what if all of this is a strange unraveling of somebody who has mental illness and won't acknowledge it, refuses to acknowledge it, and instead paints these stories to kind of make sense of it all, I guess. But then you get caught up in the story. You get caught up in the lie, and then it becomes dangerous. And I cannot see why Dawn would get so upset. And then with Walter, too, because he describes his fear of, you know, what happened with Barbara as this monster waiting to get him. And then because he's doing the same shit every single day for 30 years, he eventually says, you know, even the monster on the other side of the door is normal now to me. Mm-hmm. And that also was a moment where I was like, oh my God, he's talking about mental illness right now. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to go ahead and open that door, or I'm going to stop taking my meds because I don't need them anymore. And then the horrible thing is going to happen. You know, it just the whole thing felt like a.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paying respects to that.
Yeah. Like if you just listen to that scene and imagine he's talking out about depression, it is soul crushing.
I know it's out there somewhere. Whatever killed Barbara and Molly and Calvin. Maybe this is all a mistake. But I need to stop living the same day. Even if it kills me. Whatever's out there, I want you to know I'm ready for it. I'm going to appreciate all of it, especially the food. I don't mind if I only have a year left, or a month, or a single week. I'd be happy with one new day. I can already imagine the sun on my face.
Yeah, that whole scene just really like punched me in the gut. I actually wrote in my notes as I was watching that scene, Walter lived in the basement for 30 years. You know, I talked about his routine, you know, the monster on the other side of the door, you know, what does that mean? Is it the death of his family members or Barbara specifically? And then he faces his fears. And the next line of my notes is, and then he gets hit by a fucking train. Are you serious?
Yeah.
See, I interpreted that moment as him killing himself as well.
You think so?
Interesting. Yeah.
Were there any signs in the game that led you to that, or is this just purely?
Well, I think just his hermit life, and maybe he had a clear day one day and he realized, you know, this is it. Like, I can't keep doing this. Yeah. And that was that.
And that's so tough because, like, and I mean, that's one of the biggest things about this game, right? Is I mean, it sounds stupid, like even just like saying it out loud, but I took that scene very literally. Like, yeah. I'm like, okay, he died because he got hit by a train. But I mean, when you think about it, that's really silly. You know, that's obviously not what happened. And that's sort of what one of the biggest things about the game are is you have to make sure that your skill of knowing what's reality and what your ability to tell what's real and what isn't is.
That was so good, intact. Too. I spent the entire playthrough, I think, the first half of maybe three quarters of the game, I think up until I got to Lewis's point, I was trying to figure out, like, the literal interpretation of every person's death, which was emotionally exhausting me.
Yeah.
I was so sad. I think I cried a good, like, three out of the four that I had gone through. So I was so exhausted, and then I finally got to Lewis, and Lewis touched me in a way that I was like, oh, fuck, because I remembered that it had a relation to a story, because I've actually read the story in college. I was like, this is all just, it's just a big, like, allegory for death. It's telling us this is what happens when we die. We tell these fantastical stories because we can't make sense of it. course he gets hit by a train. Once I watched PB play that, so I had already played it, I watched her. That was for me like, of course he gets hit by a train. He just spent a majority of his life underground, and that would be, you know, one of the most worst ways for him to die. So I just felt that meant, you know, how sad his experience was. Of course it's going to end that way.
That's interesting, because you do find a painted train in his living space,
right,
that he's been working on and painting, yeah, for the last 30 years. And you do...
You hear the rumble of the train.
You hear the rumble of the train, but it's the rumbling stops one day. And yeah, that's what makes him go outside. And then when you go out as Edith and you're looking along, the train tracks are broken. So it seems like there wouldn't have been a train running. So that would maybe lend to your suicide more so than getting actually hit by a train.
Right.
Yeah. It's crazy, just like the things that you miss when you get so wrapped up in the story that like you don't even think about, you know.
Absolutely.
You don't even think about how literally you're taking them and how much that
I was getting mad.
Literal interpretation doesn't make sense.
So I was like, where are my answers? Where's the chest? Yeah. Where is like the golden gem that's gonna like tell me the parts that I missed?
Sorry to laugh, but that's exactly what we do with death, isn't it? You just said it. Where are my answers? Why did this happen? Why did my friend die in a car accident? You know, why? That's crazy.
Yeah, the whole game, I feel like, just kind of reflected on itself over and over and over again, which to me is like the supreme of storytelling.
Yeah, they did an incredible job. The music, the way the game was done, and the stories themselves, holy shit.
Which is why I was so curious if maybe if you had actually played it and felt the mechanics, because when I did feel that moment with Lewis, it was because I had finally got used to like cutting the heads off of the fish, and I wasn't like feeling like an idiot, and I finally felt normal doing it. And then I think right after I felt that, it switched into him having control, and I was just like I felt it in my body. And I know if I hadn't done that with my hands, it would have been a completely different experience.
Yeah, I think that's definitely reasonable, you know, because, you know, if I'm just sitting down and watching it as opposed to playing it, which is what I had to do for this game, I was looking for those answers right away.
Right, exactly.
Instead of putting myself into, like, the body of these characters and sort of experiencing it with them, I was experiencing it totally on the outside. Yeah, I think that's totally fair.
And for me, it made it so much more cinematic because of that. Because it didn't follow any traditional game mechanic I was expecting. The mechanics themselves changed every, like, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was doing next, which, I mean, you see that in games, but not so, I think, rich as it was with Edith Finch.
Yeah, not for narrative.
Yeah, exactly. It's usually, like, I had somebody call it a walking simulator, and I screamed at them. I was like, no, this is so much more than a walking simulator.
Yeah.
You don't just point and click like this. Which is another reason why I chose this game. It blew my mind with what they can do, not only with the mechanics, but how you can go from like 2D to 3D. I can keep going about it for days.
But that's good. That's good. It means that they did everything right for you.
Is there anything about the game that sort of pulled you out of it, Todd, that like you just, that kind of rubbed you the wrong way, that you didn't enjoy, or that sort of tainted your experience a little bit, I guess?
That is a fantastic question. I think it was honestly just my first experience. It was myself. I was keeping myself from, which I tend to do. And I think I was streaming it the first time I experienced it, so that too. But yeah, I think I was looking too hard for it instead of enjoying it as a ride. I was expecting it to be a game and not like this interactive narrative movie. And I can't think of anything in specific other than I want to say, like, give me more context. But at the same time, I don't, because that's what makes it so beautiful. That's why it's this big relation to death for me, because you don't know. Like, you're never going to know what the truth is behind their stories,
yeah.
Which is so painful. But that's the heart of good storytelling. Was there anything that you didn't like specifically, Kep?
I would absolutely, you know, like we just discussed, faults that, you know, just because I didn't actually sit down and play the game myself, you know, I was experiencing it through somebody else the whole time. And I think for a game like this, it is definitely important to wrap yourself up into it a little bit more than that. But really overall, I guess the only thing I would say, and again, I'm kind of repeating myself, is maybe just like a 30 or 45 minute DLC, giving us a little bit more of Edie's backstory, especially when we get up to that old house. I want to explore that old house. I want to know what's inside there. I want to know what influenced her, what she grew up around. And I'm not really sure why I'm asking for that. I guess it's just because she's the character that we basically know the least about. And she's also sort of the centerpiece of everything. You could at least say that, you could at least argue that she is. I feel like that would be that's my biggest complaint. I wouldn't even call it a complaint, but it's like that's the thing that I want out of the game that the game did not give me.
I wish I had gotten that with my grandpa.
Oh.
That sounds strange to say, but I do wish I had known more about him and his life. It's not ever anything we really got to talk about, so I wonder if that was intentional.
Yeah, I was about to say, because I could say the same about my grandparents as well. Like, maybe that's just yet another pull to the whole idea of death and how we just don't get it all always. And we expect
hardly
it
ever.
In video games. We expect it.
Yeah. Well, and we expect it in real life too sometimes.
Yeah, totally.
But I there's actually an interesting part there in that scene where Edith is reading the book and then Dawn comes in and grabs it from her and they kind of fight over the book. If you actually look at the text in the book, it stops midway through because it's coming from Edith's perspective and Edith's memory. And obviously Edith didn't finish reading the book, so she doesn't know what the rest of the book says. So I just thought that was kind of a neat little deal that they threw into the game.
Yeah.
That the book actually cuts off midway through a sentence and it doesn't finish Edie's story. Because I definitely paused it to look to see if there was more written down to kind of see what Edie was about to say before she got cut off, because I wanted to know who the hell turned the light on.
Right. Yeah, those little details in the game are another thing that made it so rich for me. Because the whole house was full of books, which for me, it was like I was playing, like I was reading a book. That was my experience with that game, with that game fully. It was the closest thing I could draw it to. I was like, it feels like a movie, but it's so rich, it feels like a book. It did the things that books do to me. And I mean, I spent like a week after this just like reading things about it, looking into like what, like why they were. I know the creative director's mother, she died 9 months into the like making of this, which is, I'm sure, like pulls so much as to why they did put in what they put in.
I bet it was just a lot of tears during development because everything felt so real that it must have been pulling from real life experiences.
Mm-hmm. But it felt like a team was behind it, and a team was like no other team.
A bunch of stories, like, oh, this happened to me. This was my experience. Oh, you know, it's just a random thought that popped into my head to bring it back to the whole neglect thing. The kid in the tub. That's the most neglectful thing that I've ever seen.
Well, that was in Edie's, though.
I know, but just neglect as a theme in general.
You said that actually that was one of your hardest ones. Was it because of it, you know, the simple fact of it being a baby drowning, or?
Yes, and the way that they approached it as, you know, with the crazy music playing and the fact that in that moment, I knew when that kid, you know, the baby sitting in that tub, even though, you know, he does turn the faucet and adds more water, the amount he was sitting in is enough to drown a baby. So I kind of knew the moment he was sitting in there and she was arguing on the phone, I was like, oh my God, this woman's going to get this baby. She's going to kill this baby because she's not paying attention. And so just the fact that you're sitting there waiting for it to happen, I found pretty traumatizing. And then the swelling happy music as he's playing in the bath with all these toys, and then, you know, that there's this particular scene where he changes into the frog, but his arms as he's swimming are still moving like a baby's and not like a frog's.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, he's drowning right now. Like, actually, like, his arms are moving to try to like get up off of the floor of the tub, and I just
He was definitely one of the few that I was just like, I did not want to pull the lever. I tried to find so many other ways.
Yeah.
It's like, why must you do this? But that, I mean, once again, like, you know it's going to happen. I think every time I've ever been told someone is dead in my life, I knew before they told me.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, that's that specific scene for me was that. Like, you knew exactly what was going to happen. You couldn't avoid it.
Does that make it easier?
Oh, absolutely not.
Terrible to ask, but I'm curious.
I feel like it makes it worse.
Yeah. I don't know, because I feel like if you know something's coming, you know, like a family member is sick and this is impending situation, you have time to at least say stuff. I know it'll never be enough. You know, you can never say everything that you want to say, but at least you have time to try. Whereas if it is an accident or it is sudden, all of a sudden, you know, the last thing you said is, can you pick up spaghetti sauce on the way home? And then it's like that haunts you for the rest of your life.
I mean, you're sort of speaking in the context of, like, you know, an illness or something that you know is happening. But also, it's interesting to think about an experience that I had, actually, when my dad passed away. My parents had split up, I want to say, like, maybe 6 to 8 months prior to that. My mother took myself and my two brothers a couple of states down to visit my aunts, and, you know, we were just, like, staying at their house for, you know, a couple of weeks or whatever. And the night that my dad died, I remember, you know, still being very young, of course, but I remember just, like, for no reason at all, just totally out of the blue, you know, sort of on the topic of knowing, you know, or at least sort of having some perception that something has happened before it happened, just, like, having this, like, really, like, intense, like, sick feeling, like, deep in my stomach, you know, just absolutely out of nowhere, and just, like, going up to my mom and being like, hey, mom, you know, can I, you know, just like totally routine, like, hey, mom, you know, can I call dad and, like, say goodnight or whatever? She says, no, we can't do that, because this was also back in those days when, like, long distance calls were super expensive and shit like that. So, you know, you that's something that you have to think about. And, you know, I just asked her, like, over and over again, and, you know, it was just like, no, we don't want to rack up your aunt's bill, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And then, of course, you know, go home, and, like, a couple of weeks later, you know, you find out that, like, you know, he was found dead in his house, and that was the night that he died. It was, like, in, like, that moment when, like, I had that feeling, and all I wanted to do was just, like, speak to him. And
yeah, that's horrifying.
Todd, when you mentioned that, like, when you mentioned just sort of, like, knowing that it had happened before being told, like, I just, I don't know, it's it's really interesting.
And
like,
you were
just
so
a
young,
super,
and just to feel that, and have, like, and literal, like, no experience with that.
Yeah, is that what you meant,
Todd? It's like a super big, like, rabbit
hole.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, totally. Like,
I thought you meant knowing ahead of time as an illness. I had no idea that's what you meant. Tell me more. This is interesting.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. I think both are true in both regards. But, yeah, when my uncle passed away, he passed away in his 20s. And it was super devastating for my mother and her side of the family. And I was there when she got the call, and she was with my father. And she looked at him and she said, something's wrong with Donovan, before she answered the phone. And
what?
Then yeah. Yeah. And of course, I don't know if it was something as like they knew that something was going on with him. But she, like, felt it in her heart that call was, like, about that. It was coming from her sister. And, like, she, of course, like, wailed, and, you know, as we do. And in that moment, I was maybe 7, and I, you know, I didn't hear the conversation, but I knew what was going on. I knew what had happened.
That's crazy to me. That is insane.
Yeah, absolutely. And when my grandmother died, my mother came to me. I was, I think, in high school, and my grandmother was huge, huge influence in my life. And she just, like, came to me and said, "I was like, did she pass away?" And she said, "Yes." And I just kind of sat there with it, knowing before she even had to tell me. I even felt it that day. I remember specifically, like, going to class, leaving school early because I was that kid, and, like, just feeling it and wanting to call her, but I didn't call her.
Nope. Crazy. It's, like, such an intensely overwhelming thing to, like, even consider, like,
I'm overwhelmed right now with this information. Like, this goes against everything I know and understand.
Yeah. Like, this thing that we went through, like, you know, with sort of, like, knowing that something happened to this specific person before being told or having it confirmed that it happened. Like, was that actually real? Is it just, like, some weird coincidental timing sort of thing? You know,
I,
like,
do.
Oh,
I
just
truly
a kid,
believe that,
you know,
there's
it's
some form of empathy or empathic, whatever it is, that people can have, especially with, like, family members. Because I even have really close friends in my life where they give me a call and I know something's going on.
Oh my God. So immediately I went to, like, my brain is trying to rationalize and, you know, find an answer for what happened here. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, your mom saw the caller ID and it was her sister. And she went, okay, I don't usually hear from her. And so immediately something's wrong. You know, I'm trying to rationalize and think of all the things that it could be. Or you have this uncanny superpower of, like, understanding micro mannerisms on people. So, you know, you could see under their face, you know. I'm just trying to think of all these reasons of what it could be.
And it's all those things actually, they absolutely play a part of that. But yeah, I don't think it's ever something that we're going to be able to physically touch or, like, fully examine beyond theory.
Now, can I, Todd, ask you, because I know for me, like, it bothers me that I can't explain it. Does it bother you? Like, as somebody who just, like, accepts it as something that, oh, yeah, this totally is just a thing, you know?
I'm a weirdo like that, too, though. Like, I love the idea that I'm, like, nothing in space and I'm super tiny and, like, it gives me comfort. Like, everything that I don't understand is super comfortable for me. I'm not sure why, but...
What? What is wrong with you?
I don't know. Like, the uncertainty. That's incredible. Of things. I mean, not everything. Don't get me wrong. Of course, there's anxieties that come with some things. But the bigger issues, like the idea that I'm this little ant on the planet, is more comforting to me than the idea of a god. The things that we can't see, but we can understand within our hearts, like, I'm okay with that.
See, I don't know if I'm quite there. I'm there to a degree where I can say, okay, the fact that I am small and my existence is tiny and I'm made of star stuff, to me, I mean, that's my personal belief, you know, that kind of thing. Like, you know, I don't believe in a higher power or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I also don't think that we have all of our shit together right now. I don't think we have all the answers either. You know, I think, you know, what we feel like we know in science, you know, we're going to discover. Yeah. We're going to discover our own Earth is no longer flat thing at some point, you know, and I do find that comforting. But I also find the idea that I'm going to die and no longer experience anything after that fact terrifying. I that is not comforting to me at all.
Yeah. I think, and that's interesting, because now that we're talking about this and we've kind of talked about death and when I did experience it as a kid, maybe that's why, because I had dealt with death so much as a younger little nugget, I didn't have answers for those deaths. It was just like, okay, well, this is what happens. And not even just family members, I had pets. It was like, this fucking game was very similar to my experience as a child. And I felt like the game was so childlike in the fact that it was very fantastical in the way that they told the stories. So that even brought me more into that full, like, I'm thinking like a child. But yeah, maybe that's why I find it fine. I have a friend who absolutely gets numb with fear when we talk about death and, like, is it just black? Like, where do we go? What do we do? And I literally, it doesn't do anything for me. Like, I mean, of course, it's not super comforting. I'm not like, yay, I'm gonna die. But it's not like a fear that I, like, I'm ready for it. It's the one of the few things that are certain in life. And I'm just like, all right, cool. Like, I know that it's coming.
Can I ask you what you believe happens when you do die?
Well, I know that I'm absolutely not intelligent enough to fully grasp it or understand it. But I think in my mind, I like to believe that there's nothing. And then my second under that would be, like, reincarnation, hopefully, maybe, because I would really love to be a cat.
If you follow energy, it doesn't just disappear. It must become something else. So yeah. I get that. I can kind of see that with reincarnation, but I don't know if I can get behind the whole, I can become a dolphin or a cat. You know, that would be cool, but I just don't know if that...
Yeah, it's a stretch, but...
Yeah, this is a little bit of a stretch for me, but it's interesting. It's interesting to think about, and don't think for a second that I haven't completely devoured all of those unexplainable stories that people have about reincarnation. I do remember this one story about this kid from a whole other, I think, country that was able to go into this town and tell you exactly what the town was 50 years prior. I can't explain that stuff. Yeah. And that is so bizarre. And I love that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I love watching the ghost stories. It's kind of like I'm waiting for undeniable proof to kind of just smack me in the face. I'm waiting for it. I'm hoping for it. But at the same time, I'm super critical.
I don't necessarily believe in it, but I do want to bring this up just because I do find it really interesting. It's a concept of Buddhism called samsara, and it basically is It's a form of reincarnation in a sense, but and I'm actually looking it up right now because I didn't remember it all off the top of my head. There are basically five stages of reincarnation where you have hells, hungry ghosts, and then animals, humans, and gods. So basically every time you're reincarnated, you sort of like step up to sort of like a higher plane of existence, so to speak. And I find that really interesting. And like if you know, anybody has, you know, some time, anybody listening or you know, you too, if you're not familiar, definitely something really interesting to read up on.
Yeah.
But as far as like me personally, what I think happens when we die, I would also, you know, agree right away that I don't think it's fair for anybody to say this is what happens when we die and this is an absolute. And you know, I'm not necessarily trying to like
answer, what's the word I want to use questions here.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to I don't want to make a comment specifically on, you know, anybody's, you know, beliefs. Like if you need to believe that God in heaven and hell exist to if that's what gets you through your day, like, do it, please. Like, because that's really what it's about at the end of the day. You know, we find comfort in a certain belief system, even if that's a belief in nothing. And that's what gets us through our day. And like, that's great. But I tend to get very imaginative, I guess, when I do think about it. I could never say what I want. I know that much. I would never be able to say this is what I want to happen. But I find it interesting to just think about like, okay, well, maybe there's nothing. But then I sort of have this thought process of like, I cannot comprehend feeling, not even feeling nothing, but just like not feeling, you know, like that's so strange to me. And that's so like, okay, well, yeah, your brain stops. But like, what about like this energy, this part of us that we can't explain, like our souls, I guess, if that's what you want to call it, like, how does that just disappear, you know? And then it's in the night, I don't know if it's just because like I get overwhelmed by like trying to think about it or figure it out or, you know, figure out what to me makes the most sense. You know, I think about like, okay, well, there's a lot of stuff that happens in our day-to-day lives that, you know, makes me think, okay, well, maybe this is a simulation and we're all just like part of a computer program, you know, and
ooh, yeah, like, that one's, you know, one of my, like, favorite ones.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
It's really interesting to think about, you know, like in you know, when you, especially when we go back to the discussion that we had earlier about like, you know, me basically knowing that my dad was dead before I found out about it, and right, having that feeling.
Oh god.
Having that feeling like right when it happened. And you know, you think about like, okay, well, if we put this in the context of like a computer, you know, you have software on your PC that's running all the time that watches out for impending doom and errors, yeah, and that sort of thing, you know. So like, maybe that's just like my version of that. And it's just so like just overwhelmingly strange to me to even, right, begin to think about.
And here we are doing what we do after someone dies and imagining the possibilities.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think just to go back to what you're saying about that Buddhist belief, there is also a book you might want to look into. It's very short, very simple, called Jonathan Livingston Seagull by Richard Bach, which touches on the same idea that you are basically here to kind of learn what you need to learn. And until you learn that, you're going to keep repeating the same kind of story or same kind of lifestyle until you learn that. And then after you learn that, you reincarnate and you learn a new lesson and you start to kind of advance into a higher being type thing. Enlightenment, sort of. That's how you reach your enlightenment. But the idea of a simulation is super fascinating to me. But also when you said, I don't know what I would want to happen when I die. Some days I think immortality would be great or putting myself in the singularity would be amazing. But then there are other days where I think that's a nice thought. But who owns that digital space that I'm now in that I'm probably going to have to pay monthly rent on? You know, like it's just then repeating this life that I'm currently in, you know, kind of, you know, working to feed myself and house myself. And I think after 80 years of that, I'll probably be done. Like, I don't think I'll need to do that again.
And look at the stories that we tell when we do die and the narratives that we create, whether they be good or bad. Like, imagine if immortality were a thing. I feel like we gain so much from death. We gain so much life from death. And I think that's where the comfort comes with me. Is I've learned so much about death and what that is and what that looks like in my life and around me. And if I didn't have those things that I learned, I don't know who I would be.
I think that can be true for anything good or bad in your life.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah,
more absolutely. Particularly, if we're honest, it's more the bad.
Yeah.
Because
the bad stuff makes you appreciate the good when you have it. And also just I feel like the bad stuff is just a big magnifying glass or a mirror. Even better, it's a mirror and you just have to look. And it's like, oh, and then you gotta do something about it.
I don't actually know if I've ever told that story to anybody.
Oh.
Is that okay? Do you want me to leave it out?
No. Yeah, leave it in. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a really beautiful
story. It's just weird to think about. Like, I don't think I've ever, like, talked about it.
God damn.
Yeah. Good stuff. That was great. Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Todd, we definitely appreciate you being here because this was absolutely wonderful.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Do you want to tell the listeners where they can find you?
Sure. Yes, I'm Todd Real. I'm the community manager for the Geek Generation. You can find me on Twitter at Todd Real, or Twitch, I guess. I'd rather link Rob. So twitch.tv/TheGeekGeneration. And yeah, that's me. Hello. Goodbye.
Hello. Thank you, Todd, for being here. And thank you, Captain, for being such a wonderful co-host. And thank you, Divers, for being a part of it. The Deep Dive podcast is brought to you by PBTV, and you can find us at deepdivecast.com, as well as on Twitter and Instagram at deepdivecast. You can also support us by visiting us on Patreon at Pumpkinberry. Now, patrons receive various perks like monthly black and white wallpapers, early access to episodes, bonus episode content, and of course, the knowledge that you, directly, are keeping the Deep Dive afloat. We'd also like to invite you to join us every Monday morning at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we air the episodes live and have a deep dive session with the listeners in chat. Come join in on the conversation at twitch.tv/pumpkinberry. The Deep Dive podcast is proudly part of the Geek Generation Network. For more podcasts about your favorite geeky things like games or your favorite shows, browse our whole library at thegeekgeneration.com.